So our question was, who is the new minority in the big cities? Actually, the only people who answered correctly were the people with a migration background. They usually would say, it's the white people without migration background.
What if migration isn't something that just happens, but something that is made? Welcome to Production Side, the podcast about the societal negotiation of migration. We explore how migration is produced through policies, institutions, and categories. And we ask, what role does migration research itself play in this process?
Hi, everyone. My name is Norma Shemshad. I'm a social geographer, and I'm working in the Lower Saxony research cluster Futures of Migration here at the IMIS. I'm hosting this episode together with my colleague Jens Schneider, anthropologist and coordinator of our SFB's Reflexivity Lab. So Jens, tell us about our two guests, Maurice Krühl and Franz Lely, and their project Becoming a Minority. Why should our listeners know about this project?
Well, thanks, Norma. Maurice Krühl is professor of sociology and Franz Lely a research fellow at the Free University in Amsterdam. The Becoming a Minority project examines the challenges and opportunities that the rapidly increasing diversity in towns and cities, some call it superdiversity, brings for local communities and neighborhoods. What makes their project unique, and also explains the title of the project, is that they particularly look at the non-migrant population in these superdiverse neighborhoods, in or over in several European cities. This is not only a widely overlooked group in research and the political debate, but the research focus also forces us to rethink the concept of integration. Maurice Krühl and Franz Lely were in here in Osnabrück to present their findings, and I took the opportunity to interview them for this podcast.
Great, Jens. Let's jump into your conversation with them, and afterwards we will have a chat about what we've heard and what we've learned.
So, hello, Franz. Hello, Maurice. Nice to have you here. You've recently published two books, also in German, that are based on your Becoming a Minority project, short BAM. The title of one of the books is The New Minority. Who is that minority?
Well, this is a question that we really like to pose to people when we started the project. So our question was, who is the new minority in the big cities? And people came up with the most fantastic groups, and they were trying to figure it out. But actually, the only people who answered correctly were the people with a migration background. They usually would say, it's the white people without migration background. So there you have the answer.
So how did you come to the idea to look at people without a migration background in increasingly diverse neighborhoods?
Well, it has a long history. We've been doing research into people with a migration background and the children of immigrants in Europe for more than 25 years. And of course, if you do a research, you need a control group. And this was our control group, the people without a migration background living in the same cities, in the same neighborhoods. And that's how we got information about them. They struck a chord in us. We thought, wow, why, if we are looking into integration, into migration, why is there no research into the people without migration background who are forming the context of the city where people have to integrate?
So your outcomes, how are they doing? Are they suffering from migration in these neighborhoods, or are they all multicultural romantics and defenders of diversity?
They are suffering greatly here. No, we found, of course, the whole scala. And that was also the idea, to both ask people questions if they sort of see diversity as enriching, but also ask them to if they see diversity as a threat. And so we found the whole scala of people there. So what you found in the media, people who are concerned about increased diversity, and people said that say, oh, I came to the city because I actually love to be in a diverse place, and I don't come from a diverse place, and I find it exciting to live in such a place. So we found both.
But there is, of course, the widespread discourse or narrative in media and in certain political parts of the spectrum that these are horrible neighborhoods, that people feel bad that there's a lot of problems and, yeah. and that this increases the non-cohesion in neighborhoods.
It was also, in a way, a personal quest because we actually live in such a neighborhood already for more than 30 years. Our children have grown up in such a neighborhood. So we also saw that contrast between what is in the media about these kind of neighborhoods and our actually existence in that neighborhood, which in general was a positive experience. So, but we also see people in our neighborhood that are negative about diversity. So that was actually also the reason to look into it, see under which conditions, and that is the main question of the book also, people can live pleasantly together. What is needed to live pleasantly together? Because we do say it doesn't happen by itself, especially the inter-ethnic encounters in the neighborhoods, they don't happen by itself, especially people without migration background, say the white Dutch people in Amsterdam, they tend to self-segregate in their own ethnic group.
One of your most important findings is that we need to distinguish between attitudes, what people think about it, and actual practices. So how does that work? How does that spell out?
Well, we found, and that was very interesting, we found quite a contradiction between what people have as an attitude, what they think, what they say about diversity. And then if we look at their practice, it could be totally the opposite. So this made us think about how to combine this. And we made a matrix where we asked people about their attitudes, about their opinions on migration and on diversity. And we asked them about their practices. And these two axes gave an insight in a group that is absolutely negative about diversity if it comes to what they say about it. But if you ask them, do you have a mixed group of friends? Do you have good, positive contact with your neighbors with a migration background? How would you evaluate your contact with colleagues with a migration background? They are positive about this. So this is a very contradictory group. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we also found a group that is very positive about diversity. But if we ask them if they have any meaningful contact with people with a migration background, they go blank. No, they don't.
So what size have these groups in relation to what is the biggest group?
It's very much dependent on educational level. And what we found is actually a bit contradictory to the general image, is that actually the people with more practical education, vocational education, they tend to have more friendships and acquaintances with a migration background. They're sort of more integrated into the neighborhood where the majority is of a migration background, while the higher educated group has less of these contacts. But they are more often positive mm-hmm. about diversity. There you see the contradiction again. So they have sort of high moral ideas about diversity, but in practice, they don't engage so much with people with migration background. So these are very, very big groups, especially under the higher educated people. The majority is very positive, but doesn't have really a lot of contact. Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot to win.
Yeah.
Because they have the positive opinion. So that's when we started to look into why do they not engage. And there we came to a totally new insight, actually. And we coined it, well, we didn't come up with this term. It's belonging uncertainty. And this is a term that was used in the United States for Black people who feel belonging uncertainty in white environments. And we used it to describe the feeling of white people without migration backgrounds who live in super diverse neighborhoods where the majority has a migration background, and they feel this belonging uncertainty and are hesitant to enter into spaces where they form the minority and are afraid to say something wrong. And there we found that there's a lot to gain to think of ways to overcome this belonging uncertainty, which enables then contact. Mm-hmm.
You also described that many of those without a migration background are actually not native to the neighborhoods where they live. So yep. They moved there before studies or for work. differently to most of the inhabitants with a migration background.
Yeah.
So how would you say, do they actively seek these neighborhoods? Do they want to live in them, or do they end up there because rents are cheaper, or because they are the arrival neighborhoods, not only for migrants, but also for the natives from somewhere
yeah.
else?
Yeah, it's always a mix. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's not one reason. As you know, of course, many of the neighborhoods that where the migrants to first generation settled were lower class, working class neighborhoods. So in general, they had cheaper rents. So it's an attractive neighborhood, for instance, for students to find an apartment. But again, there's often a mix. The students, again, higher educated. For them, often the excitement of going to a big city, which is multicultural, is a sort of interesting experience. So there's also sort of positive attitude there, I guess. So it's a mix of feelings, I think, that drive people into these neighborhoods. And there is, of course, people for which it's not a choice, because it's the only choice because the rents are low there. And they could also have negative ideas about diversity, but they are sort of stuck in a situation where they actually don't want to be.
What about those who were native to the neighborhoods, who have been living there their whole lives? Do they express, I don't know, kinds of loss?
It's a very small group.
How do they assess the change that they most likely have experienced over the course of their lives, especially if they are older or not the youngest cohort?
Well, first of all, you have to realize that it's a very small group.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for instance, in the city of Rotterdam, only 1 out of 10 people has parents who also were born in Rotterdam. So it's really a very small group. And of this group, of this 1 out of 10, the majority has a migration background. It's really a very small group. So there's a lot
of foreigners. But there are people that grew up in the neighborhood, for instance. Maybe their parents came from another city, but they grew up there. And we again see an interesting split. There's people that went to mixed schools already in the 80s because it was a neighborhood where a lot of migrant families lived and their children went to school there. Also has a lot of friendships with children of migrant families, long-standing friendship. But there's also a group that had negative experience growing up in the neighborhood, in the schools, and sometimes with other pupils with a migrant background. And this is a group that expresses a lot of loss. You see also that they are avoiding contact. It's also a group that says they are in conflict a lot in the neighborhood. So loss means actually that you live in a neighborhood that you consider opposite to your ideas and opposite to your wishes. And that brings people into a sort of downward spiral of conflict and negative experiences. And there the loss is very big, yeah.
I mean, you compared a lot of neighborhoods in the different cities. So can you say something about the characteristics of neighborhoods that are more positive or that get more positive outcomes and the characteristics of neighborhoods that tend to be more negative?
Yeah, it's something we were also interested in. Characteristics could be a prominent example. What we found is the architectural of the housing. So high rise, for instance, where there is 10 floors and sometimes a few hundred people living in a high rise. There's a lot of anonymity in these places. People often don't know their neighbors by name. So, and there we saw that small conflicts about you, for instance, loitering in the hallways, are named often in ethnic terms. So normal conflicts about you causing noise, being late at night in the street, are ethnically named. And we see that smaller units, where there is, for instance, 6 families living on a staircase in older buildings, people know each other by name. And if there's something, you would say, hey, what are you doing? Or you would address the parents of these people. And then they don't get to be conflicts in the first instance already, but also they are not considered ethnic conflicts, but just conflicts with youth that normally happen in places where children play outside. So we saw a big impact on how housing is organized in these neighborhoods.
So anonymity is kind of the main enemy of
absolutely, yeah.
Okay. And what about cities? Did you find differences between the six cities?
Well, there we found interesting differences how things are organized. And a prime example there is schools. School choice is always important. If you have places where school choices allow you to send your child outside of your neighborhood, for instance, to a school which has less immigrant children, white flight, there's a huge impact on how people live then in such a neighborhood. Because, yeah, then you don't know the other children in your neighborhood because your kid doesn't go to school with these kids. If you go to the playground, you don't recognize the other parents and their children. So there's less contact as a result. And in places where children more often go together to school in the neighborhood, there you see more contact and more friendships between parents also as a result. So how we organize things in institutions has an important impact on what we see in our outcomes.
And what about public discourse? I can imagine, like, for example, Rotterdam is much more harsh and much more right-wing, dominated than Amsterdam, for example. Vienna is probably more right-wing or more anti-migrant discourse than you would find in Malmö, maybe, I don't know.
However, again, this is about discourse, opinions, but practice is not always following the discourse. And Rotterdam is a very interesting example because already for 15 years there's an anti-immigrant party in the coalition ruling the city. And still, you see that on the ground in this super diverse city, which has almost 60% people with a migration background. And for the youth under 15, it's, I think, now only 1 out of 4 has no migration background. So on the ground, actually, the practice is pretty similar as in other cities.
But of course, it has an impact on indirectly on policies, of course. In Rotterdam, there is already for 20 years an anti-immigrant party, part of the coalition that rules the city. So in that sense, again, that impacts how things are organized. Maybe not so much how people interact with each other. So an interesting thing we found is that people say that diversity is threatening if they live in Vienna or in Rotterdam or in Amsterdam. Of those, half of them in practice in each city do something contradictory to what they say. They have good relationships with their neighbors with a migrant background. So the percentages are the same. But the group, of course, is bigger in Vienna that is negative about diversity. Mm-hmm. And the group in Rotterdam is also bigger. So in that sense, there is an impact. But then it's also, okay, so the politics also reflect a bit the attitudes of people. So what is first? Is it the politics or it's the attitudes? Or is there a sort of interaction between politics and attitudes of people?
A central concept in your work, in your book, is this majority-minority city thing, let's say. When we look at the cities that you looked at, Hamburg is not a majority-minority city. But of course, as all cities, I guess, in Europe, they have majority-minority neighborhoods, and that's where you did your research. But does it make a difference, let's say, if a city as a whole is a majority-minority city or if it just refers to a certain neighborhood?
Yeah, well, during the corona period, we were asked to do a survey by the city council. And we used a lot of the same questions that we used for the BAM survey. Because
about social cohesion.
Social cohesion and interaction and contact. And there we didn't restrict ourselves to the majority-minority neighborhoods, but we looked at all the neighborhoods. So it was an interesting case to see, okay, is the picture very different than in the majority-minority neighborhoods? And again, in terms of attitudes, not so much. Neighborhoods who had a lot of higher class people, which often have better education levels, of course, they were again a bit more positive about diversity. So again, the same phenomena. But they had less contact, which is sort of obvious because they don't live in a majority-minority neighborhood. So, but we saw, in a way, we saw the same phenomena there. Yeah. So positive about diversity often, but in practice, not so much.
Mm-hmm. Maybe as a final question, in Germany at least, I perceive a certain reluctance in left-wing and liberal circles to embrace the idea of majority-minority neighbor cities, also because there's this right-wing discourse of, okay, migration makes us becoming, as Germans, becoming a minority in our own country. And I think that the reluctance probably is because they feel that if we now underline how many places Germans are becoming a minority in these neighborhoods, that this feeds into this right-wing discourse. How do you deal with that? Or do you get similar reactions also in the Netherlands? Or what would be your argument, say, against?
Well, that's exactly why we wanted to do this research. So let's see, okay, in a situation, this is sort of what right-wing political parties say, this is what we're all afraid of. So let's look at places that have this composition. Is this places where there's a constant war going on? Do people do not like to live in these neighborhoods? Are they in conflict with each other all the time? And by and large, we didn't find that sort of findings.
We had this discussion also in the US. People were really reluctant to talk about this because they said it would play into the negative scenario of the right. Exactly what Maurice is saying. We were saying, look at the practice. What is going on? And as it is a reality that we have to face, let's look into what are the options to make it work.
So, when you even look at those people that vote for these right-wing parties, in practice, they don't do what the right-wing parties suppose they are doing. They have a lot of them have good relationships with their neighbors with a migration background and colleagues with a migration background. So even those that are sort of supporters of these parties actually in practice don't do what they predict will happen. I think that's an important finding, and that's also an important finding in the sense that if we are not focused so much on their attitudes, but maybe more on their practices, these neighborhoods could work well as a place where people from different backgrounds live. Because also they contribute to a positive atmosphere in these neighborhoods. If they are friendly to their neighbors, they contribute to a successful neighborhood. If they are friendly to their colleagues or in the shops, that's positive.
They have a nicer life. This is also how we came to the term integration into diversity, as opposed to the old integration paradigm where only the people with a migration background have to integrate into the majority society. At the moment when there is no longer a majority of people without a migration background, you have to sort of find new ways to make your life work on a daily basis in these neighborhoods. And if you ask of everybody to integrate into this diversity, then you make a step to go away from this whole idea of loss and to find new ways to interact and to be together.
And that in the end is the real progressive answer to this question, because right-wing parties don't have an answer to this question.
And ignoring doesn't make it go away.
The answer is that we should not have this situation. But they don't have an answer of how do we live pleasantly together. And I think what progressive people need to do is to find ways to live pleasantly together. But I think the fault of the left wing has been that they think this happens by itself. But we have to really organize this and help people to connect to each other to make this a success. So, and if this is a program, I think this is a strong program against right-wing discourse, because then you really bring something to people rather than only say this is problematic and this should not be how we should live together.
Although I think it's also one argument that we have to rethink our ideas about what means to be Dutch, what means to be German. I mean,
absolutely.
Just two numbers. And in a majority minority, in most of the majority minority, 75% have German citizenship. And 80% of the teenagers and children are native born, 80 to 90%. Yeah. So these are our kids. These are the kids that go to school there. They
That's
are completely
the reality.
Socialized.
Yeah.
So these are the new Germans, the new hamburgers, the new.
Absolutely.
Amsterdam.
But the left wing parties have this discourse. These are the new Germans and these are our people. But they don't have a program how to do this. so that everybody feels to belong in the cities, to connect to each other. And I think we need to develop a program together, bottom up, how to do this better, because we failed. And the group that is very positive about diversity but has no connections is a sort of a showcase that we failed. And we need to do a better job.
Well, thanks a lot. We take that home as our message.
Thank you for having us.
So thank you.
Jens, I've really followed your conversation with Maurice and Franz with great interest, and I was wondering what my takeaways from the interview about their research were. I think firstly, what stuck with me was the idea of integration into diversity, because it reframes an entire debate. In cities where no single group constitutes a majority, the old integration paradigm that minorities must adapt in one way or another to a so-called white majority is obsolete. All residents, including white people without migration backgrounds, must actively learn to navigate and co-create diverse spaces. This requires deliberate effort and not passive coexistence. I also thought about attitudes and behavior and how they can diverge significantly. I found surprising how people with negative views on diversity often have more meaningful real-world encounters with migrants, especially those with vocational training, while highly educated people who more often than not celebrate diversity frequently have little actual contact with migrants. That matrix of attitude versus action, to me, was quite central to their research. Another point that crossed my mind was that on public discourse and lived practice and how they too often contradict each other. Rotterdam, for example, has some of the most anti-immigrant political rhetoric in the Netherlands, and yet nearly 60% of its residents have a migration background, and on-the-ground social practices resemble those in other cities. Even voters for right-wing parties tend to not really always act in line with those parties' positions. While I find those findings encouraging, there is a risk of underplaying the cumulative and sometimes indirect effects of anti-migrant discourse, I believe. For example, on policy, on institutional behavior, on how migrants themselves feel in public spaces. I'm thinking of recent research from Germany, for example, that showed very clearly how many individuals who migrated to Germany actually considered leaving the country due to the hardening rhetoric. Other research shows that political discursive framings shape social norms over time, even when individual behavior lags behind. And so I'm also thinking about the anti-diversity logics behind some of the urban policies. These impact who lives together. So while discourse may not change how neighbors greet each other, it may well change who greets who in the neighborhood.
Yeah. I think that's a good point, although I don't think that the book really intends to downplay the detrimental effects of anti-immigration discourse. I think they were rather surprised to find that there seems to be no one-to-one relationship between political rhetoric and how people think and act, and that there seems to be some level of resilience, nurtured, I guess, by biographical and daily life experiences. We find this, by the way, also in the outcomes of the Integrationsmonitor of the Sachverständigenrat, you know, the SVR, that consistently shows that people are much more positive about migration and diversity, etc., than one might expect after decades of anti-migration discourses also in the political mainstream.
That's a really good point. Another thing that sat slightly uneasy with me was the use of the category migration background, of course. I mean, it's not a very new critique. That said, you know, migration background is a quite complicated category. It doesn't only vary considerably across national contexts, but is also notoriously slippery. In Germany, for instance, it can be extended to third-generation descendants. It also conflates very different experiences, including recent arrivals, long-settled communities, and EU mobility, while simultaneously relying on a racialized visual marker, that's white, that the framework never fully interrogates. How do we deal with that in our effort that to move beyond exactly these markers?
Yes, I completely share the uneasiness with that category, but here it's basically a methodological question and choice for the quantitative part. How to sample people who do not have a migration experience on their own and or grew up in a family with such an experience? Yes, it still makes a big difference whether people came as refugees or through family unification or as students or with a work contract, whether they were born here or not, or even their parents already grew up here. if they came within the past 3 years or 30 years ago. The funny thing is, the category works relatively good for those who do not have a migration background. So it is still, of course, a compromise. It entails a lot of fuzziness and suggests a homogeneity that obviously does also not do justice to the variety of biographical experiences of those who statistically do not have a migration background. But that's unavoidable, I would say, in a quantitative study on this topic.
Clearly, that category allows for a quantitative approach and also to capture what they referred in your conversation as control group, which are the white people without migration backgrounds, definitely. A last takeaway for me would also be the relevance of structural factors. Franz and Maurice mentioned the role of architecture, for example, and obviously livability depends on the quality of housing. But there are other factors such as poverty, unemployment, family situations, bad school experiences. How able and willing am I to become a volunteer coach for youth football in my neighborhood when I can hardly pay my rent? Not all of these can be directly tackled by local policies, of course, but there are plenty of possibilities. And on the other side, the lack of policies or the wrong policies can really make things much worse.
I think that's an excellent point, Norma, and I think it also shows that we have to reach out with this kind of research results to policymakers, to practitioners. But it also shows that in these questions, people share. The difference is not between people with and without migration background. The difference is between class or between income.
Thank you for listening to Production Side, the podcast about the societal negotiation of migration. If this episode made you think, subscribe and spread the word. You can find all credits, sources and further links in the show notes and at producingmigration.org. Production Side is produced by the Collaborative Research Center Production of Migration at Osnabrück University, funded by the German Research Foundation in collaboration with Podcast Fabrik Bielefeld. New episodes are available wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, and until then, what's being produced right now?